So we're kicking it. We're going to kick it tonight. And we have the mood lighting is back.
Yeah.
So
mood lighting.
Yeah.
Not
moonlighting.
David
and Maddie. Yeah. No, it's mood lighting. Yeah. So for a while, you know, we lay the tracks. We record these little chestnuts at Mark's office. And for the past couple of weeks, and you really can't tell when you listen back to the show, but take my word for it, those shows were recorded in fluorescent lighting, and it's just not the same. It's just a little...
It's a little harsh.
Well, it feels, frankly, like, you know, just a little bit less authentic, so...
It's much more of an incandescent type of show.
Yeah, and if you can take the last two shows, for example, and just, you know, play them back on an old turntable... That would be really the way to try it.
Need some crackles and pops in there.
Yeah.
We do have a lonely empty chair again.
Oh, yeah, but he's getting closer.
No. It looks like he may rejoin us, which made me wonder, do we have our own personal Morrissey for this show?
Oh, yeah. Are you surprised?
Not necessarily, but I've known the gentleman a long time, and... yeah, it's not necessarily out of character. I love him. But yeah, Shane is not joining us this evening.
Yeah, well, we'll see him when we see him. Hopefully it'll be next week. But if not, you know, keep the vigil going for another.
A lonely candle. Yeah. Yes. We'll have some sort of Hanukkah event.
We need to get somebody to put together a ballad. Like just, you know, just like a... some sort of sad song.
Tweet your vigil candle photos. Your Instagram vigil candle.
Oh, yeah.
Photos
yeah. You can send those to, you can tweet us at somebody_likes.
Yeah.
Because we Twitter handles are good.
Or you can email us at
message somebody.
Message somebody@gmail.com.
Yes. Or you can do those two things simultaneously, in which case you're very, very talented.
I'd be very impressed.
We have, by the way, also just a little bit of housekeeping because everybody loves that at the top of the show. We have, we've had a few requests recently. Thanks for those. If you haven't sent something in, there's really something you'd like for us to take a crack at, let us know. And some of these we'll get to sooner and some of these we may get to later, and we can't promise that we'll get to all of them, but we do appreciate the feedback. So
anyway,
even negative feedback, like if you hate us, let us know.
Or if you're just not sure, or if you're like the guy in, where was he? Switzerland.
That guy didn't like us, right?
It was more dislike than like, but he was also, you know, this show has a certain Swiss component, and I don't just mean that there are holes in it. I mean,
we do eat chocolate a lot of times.
Yeah, well, there's also that. But Mark was born in Switzerland, so I just just want to say that like maybe we need to make a better effort at tailoring more of our material to that guy.
Okay.
To the Swiss demographic.
Yes, the one guy who's already turned off our show and will never turn on again. Anyway, Ryan, you were going to say let's do the theme music, then we'll get into what's going on.
Okay.
Sounds like a plan.
I'm Kevin.
I'm Ryan.
I'm Mark.
This is Somebody Likes It.
So Lindsey Buckingham got fired from Fleetwood Mac.
Yeah. Yeah, if you can't hold down a job as a rock star.
Well, dude, he's been with them since, what was it, 76 or some shit? Like,
well, it's just going to mean that he...
74?
He probably needs to tweak the way that it shows up on his resume.
But anyway, I mean, maybe to his credit...
Why was I the only one that thought it was funny?
I know. Well, it was funny.
Tweet it to his resume? Like, I don't...
No.
He would have to tweak his resume.
Tweak his resume.
He's in a band, Ryan. None of those guys have resumes. Yeah. It's really fine to move on. But but he's getting replaced by...
two people.
Neil Finn, right?
Neil Finn
from Crowded House.
And Mike Campbell of Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, now that there's no Tom Petty.
Yeah.
That guy was free.
Yeah. I bet he wasn't free.
Well, I'm sure he cost money.
Sure.
But you got to think, if you're Lindsey Buckingham and you get fired and they have to take two, like, semi-legendary guys to replace you, you take some solace in that.
Oh, sure. Yeah. And I'm sure that that band doesn't care whether they're playing with exactly the same headcount as before, just as long as they can spin those songs out when they go on tour.
Some of those songs he wrote and sang, so I don't know how that's going to work out.
Well, he probably won't sing them.
I would imagine not.
Or just remotely to himself. Okay, yeah, so the other thing that is worth mentioning is that Mitzi Shore died today.
Polly's mom.
Polly's mom.
And proprietor of, what was it, the Comedy Store?
She was the owner and proprietor of the Comedy Store, and really, for lack of a better term, was kind of the gatekeeper to stardom.
People who would show up on The Tonight Show and then later have their own sitcoms had to go through her first.
Yeah, well, and it was, and not everybody did, and not everybody that she didn't, give the high five or the best slot to or whatever. She wasn't the only arbiter of whether somebody was successful or not.
She was a big one, though.
She was a big one. And, I know that it popped up in that Shandling documentary that Judd Apatow did that he did not like her. And I don't think, it sounds like.
That Gary Shandling didn't like
her. Gary Shandling didn't care for her.
Yeah.
And I think she was a tough customer, but. It was a really great article that popped up in BuzzFeed. It's not a listicle, so I didn't know what to do with it. But which is
could have made your own list.
Yes, the top 10 things that I took away from this article. No, but it was all about that house that is like essentially right behind the Comedy Store, and when she bought the club, or actually her husband bought the club, Sammy Shore, who was kind of a small time comic. Bought the store right before, and at the time, like, really, New York and Vegas were really the only places where you could go see, big-time touring comedians. And then Carson decided to move out to Burbank from New York, and that really started to change the scene. And so, anyway, between 79 and 89, like, really, that was kind of a de facto. Mitzi Shore apparently looked at that house. Kind of considered that house like comedy college. And so you're talking about, everybody from Kinison to Dice Clay to Jim Carrey, Mark Maron, Robin Williams, Richard Pryor, Yakov Smirnoff, apparently, Bill Hicks. And
Russia, comedy has you.
Yes, exactly. And then apparently, this I thought was really interesting, a guy who was billed as somebody who was part of Kinison's Outlaws of Comedy crew, whose name I don't remember, Alan Steffen, ended up being the showrunner for Roseanne. Like, I guess the original run of that show.
One would imagine.
Anyway, it's odd. And so, but basically that guy says that house that Mitzi Shore owned, where all those, that was like basically this big comedy crash pad for 10 or more years, was kind of the frat house of that comedy college scene where everybody was cutting.
I think that's kind of a thing for the most established comedy clubs is that they'll have some sort of flop house that they, keep their touring comics.
Yeah, that's true, but this one was more established and
Animal House of touring comics.
Yeah. So anyway, but at the very least, so lots of nice things being said on Twitter and presumably other places in social media about Mitzi Shore, who died today. She was 87, I think, and had been sick for a while. But anyway, yeah, gatekeepers. Gatekeepers to get you on, really specifically to get you on the Carson Show, because at that point, there weren't as many outlets that were breaking stars.
Well, I think I told you I just recently saw and TiVo'd Gary Shandling's first appearance on The Tonight Show.
Yeah. No, you mentioned that.
And then I saw Jerry Seinfeld's. I didn't uh-huh. TiVo that one, but I saw that one recently. And so get yourself some rabbit ears because there's some gold out there.
All right. Well, anyway, so neither of those recent developments are why we're here tonight. We're here to talk about. So the way that I kind of set this up last week was I mentioned that. So this time last year, we did a show on the Lemon Twigs, who were the emerging artist, Grolke Prize winner. Ryan will say who Brent Grolke was. You want to say?
Brent Grolke was the creative director of South by Southwest music for many, many years.
Yeah, passed away a few years ago. And so they named this prize
during
after him,
oral surgery,
which you always share. So be very careful with your oral surgeon. But anyway, yeah, so they developed this prize, and they give out a few different things every year. But the one that we that I kind of circled last year was the emerging artist category, and the Lemon Twigs record was really fun. And I enjoyed the hell out of talking about it. And I frankly, like, sometimes I don't always get around to see as many bands as I would like. And so these guys, the guys that we're going to talk about tonight, which is a band from L.A. called Starcrawler, won that Brent Grolke Emerging Artist Prize for this year. And so anyway, and there is a lot to talk about with this band.
Well, okay, yeah. Couple things. They're kids, like,
yeah,
more or less.
Well, and the, you know what? That's true. Yeah, they range in age from 17 to 22. And
one of them's still in high school or being tutored.
Yes,
still
yeah,
in high school.
Yeah, that's true. But beyond that, like, yes, so they're very young. And it occurred to me that, like, so were the Lemon Twigs. Like, yeah. That's a, one of the things that we talked about in that show last year was that in the kind of, you know, the highlight photo of that band on stage at South By, you can clearly, Shane pointed out, you could clearly see the X on the hand of the lead guitarist.
Oh, meaning like, don't give this guy a drink?
Yeah, because he's not of age.
Yeah.
And so anyway, so I don't know if, and I frankly just haven't looked and haven't cared enough to look, whether the emerging artist always has to be somebody who is just at the very beginning of their career. But these guys, for a band of a bunch of, literally a bunch of kids, like, are, come from Hollywood lineage. And so there's a lot of crazy backstory, and the act is over the top.
The act is over the top, yes.
Well, so I did my traditional thing where I just go through and listen to it without having read anything. And I was like, oh, it's like a, you know, grunge / Riot Girl kind of situation.
Sure.
And then went back and listened to it, and all the articles that I was looking up talk about Black Sabbath. And I was like, yeah, I guess kind of.
There's more Nirvana in there than there is Black Sabbath, it feels like. But
right.
I do think
and the grunge bands were influenced by Black Sabbath, so sure. I guess that's the thing.
I mean,
she
counts Ozzy Osbourne as a huge influence, but I don't.
That wasn't the number one thing I came away with just having listened to it with fresh ears.
Yeah.
Now, like, I going back and listen to it a second time, like, I can kind of see it. You know, there's a little bit that's sludgy. I just came away with a lot more of, like, just they sound like they're really into grunge, like early 90s stuff. Now, granted, none of them were alive then.
Sure.
But
maybe the 22-year-old. So she is
Arrow.
Arrow DeWild, who is the daughter of among two people, but one of them one of them is photographer Autumn DeWild, who's a rock photographer who also does a lot of fine artwork. And she is responsible for the key photograph that they build all the marketing campaign around for I, Tonya. So it's like,
oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Right on.
There you go. Yeah. So anyway, so yeah, this kid grew up around...
Her father's drummer.
Yeah, her father...
Played
yeah.
with Ariel Pink Graffiti and...
Yeah, and she grew up around... She grew up around, Elliot Smith and Beck. And actually, that's Beck's daughter, 10-year-old daughter, that's on the cover of the record.
Wait, so, the thing, like, that looks older than...
She's 10, and in fact, when
this
they...
person?
Yes. Yeah,
that's
a 10-year-old.
Like, horrific Courtney Love-looking thing?
Yep. Yeah, that's Beck's daughter. Little Miss Hansen.
So what kept occurring to me while I was, you know, listening to this, and especially when I started, like, looking into their press, is, like, you know, when people start bands and they're in high school, they think they're just going to hit it big. Like, all of them do.
Yeah.
And this one, it looks like it's just actually going to happen, which is kind of a bad lesson for everybody else.
Yeah.
Like, you know, set your expectations.
But I do, but there else, there is something to be said. And they, you know, we'll get into the music itself and the band and like their chops. But it does help to like to
have a million connections.
Have a million connections. Her mother shot album covers for Elliott Smith, Beck, Jenny Lewis, and Childish Gambino. Like, that's a, you know,
those are good contacts to have.
They're good contacts to have. You know, if you were, yeah, if you were, you know, if you're putting together your rock and roll resume, you want to just put those down. I don't know why we're there's so many there are a lot of
you know,
rock
we need
and
to
roll
let
jobs
Lindsay know that.
Yes. Yeah, clearly. Anyway. Yeah. So I don't know. But that's Beck's little girl.
Yeah, well I guess they've got her all this is kind of the horrific backside of like having your kid in beauty pageants. Like it's you know, having your kid in like look scary pageants.
Well, when they did their in January before they started playing a bunch of shows out, when this record was I guess queuing up, they did a show at Amoeba Records in L.A. and they had Beck's daughter come out and introduce the band. And so here's this 10-year-old kid who just very you know awkwardly and shyly introduces this band who then apparently proceeds to just rip the lid off the place like there weren't people shopping for records 5 feet away from them.
Why don't we get into a track?
Let's do that. Let's play one. So I think let's do let's start with Love's Gone Again. So that track is, you know, comes in at a very Dolly Parton-esque 226.
Yeah, but it does kick all kinds of ass.
It does kick all kinds of ass.
I just wonder, like, and like they are getting a lot of attention. I just wonder if there's room in the musical landscape with all the, you know, prefab beats and synthesizer and backup dancers and all that shit for this to exist. Like, I hope so. Because I fucking love this record.
Yeah, no, it's a fun listen, and you know, and clearly, like, there's sort of, you know, you get the impression it's like these guys wouldn't. How could you take a show off? Like, if that's what your sound is, like, there's no way. There are no ballads here.
No, they're not. They're not. You know, sleepwalking through anything. And it's and sometimes this is used as kind of a behind the back pejorative when people are like, hey, what'd you think of our set? Oh, you guys were really tight. Meaning that the songs aren't that good, but like, yeah. You know, you definitely like know your parts. But they are really tight on this. And I tried to bring it up earlier, but Ryan Adams produced this, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, he did. Yeah. And well, and it was another one of those deals, too, where it's like. So there's a really terrific Vulture article about there are a lot of terrific articles about this band, but one that I thought was particularly interesting was this Vulture take, and I'll just share a little bit of this because it encapsulates the Ryan Adams thing. Ryan Adams would be totally almost did
that. Yeah. Well, the thing that he gets really mad about.
I know. it's just a little.
I don't know if it was in Austin here at the time or somewhere, if I brought it up on the show, but like somebody like was calling out. During one of his shows, Summer of 69, and he got really pissed.
And then he played it once. Like, I think maybe in Nashville right? or something. Like, he was yeah. just like, fuck it, I'm going to play it.
Father John Misty was in the audience, and he did it.
He could have been. That would have been perfect.
By the way, Father John Misty is another act that Arrow's dad played with. So that, you know,
of course,
they're, yeah, they're just yeah. checking off all the boxes. But anyway, so this Vulture article, it says it was from the shows that the band got the attention of Ryan Adams, the prolific rock and roller and the denim jacket connoisseur who produced Starcrawler's album at his Pax Am studio. He says, I was hearing rumblings about a new band in L.A., playing gigs in warehouses and abandoned strip malls, that sort of thing. I found a few shows. There was nothing that especially spoke to my vibe. Then I went to see Starcrawler, and it felt like being hit by four trains at once. Musically, I was in after that one single show in a weird alleyway, and I might as well have been seeing Kiss playing on the moon. So Ryan Adams,
I don't know about
is,
that last part, but okay.
Ryan, well, you know, whatever. Ryan Adams has never been shy when it comes to hyperbole. And I do think that, like, when I knew a little bit of this sound and then knew that he produced it, that felt like a little bit of a disconnect. Like, musically, they don't sound anything alike.
Well, you know, alt-country pop-esque.
Sure. Well, philosophically, what sounds like happened was, like, basically he set it up. And it's funny, too, because I think so often it's hard for producers, especially if they think that something's going to be heard, to just leave well enough alone. And he basically set these guys up to do live takes that sounded like their live shows, and then he was just there to, like, help them troubleshoot anything that needed to troubleshoot or answer questions. Shit like that. So it sounds like a pretty hands-off
production.
This record
sounds great.
Yeah.
And for anybody who's never, like, sat in on a recording session, and I've probably brought this up on the show at some point, miking drums is the most boring fucking thing on the planet, but it's also, like, really important. And whoever did it, like, fucking nailed it. Like, it's got punch to it.
Yeah, the drums are great. The guitars, the compression on the guitars are amazing. You get that real crunchy guitar sound, but it's not bleeding into, like, the vocal tracks or anything like that. Like, everything kind of is compartmentalized.
It's super clean, but it also sounds like they're not holding back.
Right.
Like, it doesn't sound like it, you know, like no, they're doing like a million takes of the same thing. It just all sounds really well recorded.
It is a sonic blast. Like, I do think that, like, he does it, like, Ryan Adams, in this case, does a pretty good job, it seems like, of getting out of the way. It does, like, to your point, it is clean, but I don't think it feels like it could have easily been something that could have felt precious or easily overdone, and it doesn't feel that way.
No, it still has that, like, sort of element of danger that you want from good rock.
And from young rock stars, right? Like, they're kind of at the age where, like, the guy from the owner of Rough Trade said, at that age, energy isn't the concern. Intelligence, structure, and songcraft are the concern, and they passed that. So, yeah. Anyway.
I mean, cool. I think that the sound is great. I think a lot of the buzz that, at least from a few of the articles I read that's come out of L.A. about these guys is really their live performance. And I ended up watching a few of those online. And we maybe in the break we can take a look at one of the shows that they did here in Austin just this past March. But definitely a lot of the I don't know if it's theatrical. I don't want to, like, you know, say what Arrow is really up to.
Some of it is, I think.
But I mean, the person, the Arrow that you get on stage is not the Arrow that you read, like, in interviews. Like, she seems to really kind of be in a character when she's doing this, and I think that's created a lot of that buzz.
Well, let's get in one more of these before we go to the middle of the show break. Speaking of getting in character, let's do I Love L.A. and we'll
this
watch.
Doesn't sound anything like Randy Newman?
It does
by
not
the way.
Sound like Randy Newman, and we'll watch the video too.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. So, not a Randy Newman song?
No.
Yeah, actually,
so that video is an experience.
It is an experience, and it gives you, it does give you a sense of like kind of what it's like to see them live, I assume. But she is like so thin as to almost be two dimensional.
She's 6'5" or somewhere in that range.
6'2", I think, is what she is. Yeah, she's very tall. But
physiologically, just she's
gangly,
stick.
Yeah, she's very but there is like that. So there's a great take in the Guardian review on this record where they talk a little bit about this sort of, they call it like a Ramonesy bubblegum so whatness to that song, and I was like, okay, I see a little bit of that. Like,
to me, it's like, what if Hole was actually good?
Yeah.
There are a couple Hole songs that I do actually like, but yeah. But no, these guys just kind of pull it off. But the intro to that video is like, I don't know, Monty Python on acid? Like, the hell was that?
No, I mean, that's a fair question to ask. Yeah, it's bizarre. But yeah, essentially, like, the band star is they're apparently, like, legitimately is a donuts and Chinese food place in Silver Lake. And so, yeah, they star in this video as employees of that place, and they're bad at it.
I literally have a photo on my Flickr feed. This is how bad I am with keeping up with trends on the internet, that it's on my Flickr feed. But that's a photo that says donuts, teriyaki, ice cream. And it was a strip mall place in L.A. I don't know if it's the one they're thinking of, but like,
yeah,
just choose. Dudes, like,
yeah, you don't have to be all of those things. And actually, it just seems like they've chosen some very specific things that are unrelated to each other, and they don't do anything other than those things. Yeah.
Maybe they got three partners and they couldn't decide.
Like, yeah. I don't know. But that video, like, so that song is like, upon repeated and repeated and repeated listenings, has grown on me a little bit. I didn't particularly love it when I first heard it, but it does. You do get a sense of the fact that the lead guitar shreds, that arrow is like sort of what her, the way that she presents herself on stage. And other than that, it's kind of,
I think it's a blast, man.
Yeah, no, it's a fun track. So, all right. So we're actually running a little bit over. Who's got a few minutes with tonight?
I've got middle this week. So, a band I kept coming back to listening to this week's record was L7.
Oh, yeah, I could see that.
Yeah, they put out a record called Bricks Are Heavy. It was produced by Butch Vig, who also produced Nevermind for Nirvana, drummed for Garbage. Anyway,
the band.
But they...
Not
they,
just for trash.
No, he wasn't soliciting trash.
Okay.
Appreciation for his percussion. No. Sure. But they had a song called Pretend We're Dead that easily, like, these guys could have like toured with them at this time. And yeah, they're kind of proto Riot Girl. But anyway, let's get into Pretend We're Dead by L7.
Yeah.
I guess it's like classic rock for people in their 40s. Like, that is some grunge era shit right there.
It's so great. Like, I love that song. Like, I'm fond of that. Although it did occur to me. Well, two things. One, that what you said is totally true. The band that we're, Starcrawler could totally
tour with them.
Like, it would be
a perfect bill.
Exactly congruent.
And actually, L7's got a new record coming out, and they are going on tour.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah, maybe it'll work out. But yeah, so it absolutely sounds like those bands could play together. And then I don't know. I mean, I guess the other thing is like, even though I have loved that song for a long time, it feels a little tame compared to.
I was thinking the same thing.
Yeah.
Like, I was.
You think Starcrawler's like bringing the goods more than.
Well, I mean, L7. I was looking on here, like, the. In 2017, Metal Injection ranked L7 at number 7, coincidentally, on their list of 10 heaviest grunge bands. And it just. Maybe I'm not remembering grunge properly, but this doesn't. It feels.
Well, and this is the
tame.
Studio version of that track, too. So it's like. I feel certain that, like.
Well, they did bring the danger. back in the day. And so we're watching the video, and I look over at Mark, and he's cracking up. And I was like, are you reading about the Reading Festival?
Yeah. 1992 Reading Festival. The band experienced technical difficulties with their audio equipment. And when the crowd showed their disapproval, Donita Sparks removed a feminine hygiene product from her person. And
she took out a tampon and threw it into the crowd.
I just liked. I was laughing at the part where it says on the Wikipedia page, "This has been referred to as one of the quote most unsanitary pieces of rock memorabilia in history."
Yeah.
Ironically, for sanitary hygiene.
Also,
product.
Can we just say nobody's in the right in that story? There's nobody that wins.
No.
Like
that is a weird way to take out your frustration.
That's what we're calling it. But yeah. Great story. Anyway, that track is a keeper.
For sure. Also, Butch Vig, who produced that, produced the first proper Smashing Pumpkins record, Gish.
Oh, yeah.
Which is the one that I actually really like. And if Shane was sitting here, he'd take umbrage with. But fuck him.
Yeah, well, he can do that next week.
Yeah.
All right. Well, should we get back into it?
Let's.
All right. So we're talking about Starcrawler, and we haven't spent much time other than anecdotally talking about the wunderkind guitarist, Henry Cash, who's the runs the lead acts on this. He's the guy that's 17 who is basically, I don't know, homeschooling or something.
Well, yeah, I think once the band started to get a little more, than normal successful for a high school band.
What is normal successful, by the way?
Not.
can still go to school full time.
Playing your buddy's birthday party.
Just call it what it is. Oh, that's great. That guy shreds, like, just
it's 100%
gets
true.
After it.
Yeah.
Burns that place to the ground.
Yeah, man. I don't know if they gave him his first guitar when he was like 3 or something.
Exactly.
I think it was something like that, actually. Yeah.
Was that right?
Yeah.
Really? Can I get my kids musical instruments?
Get after it.
Yeah, we'll work on it.
What are yours, 7 and 3?
Yeah, whatever. They're not gonna be that guy, but he really can flat play. And for all the talk of that we do on the show of bands with guitarist prodigies, like, to recognize one in that, like, this guy doesn't even look like he's in the nascent stages of being a rock god. Like, The funny thing is like, they kind of get described by, the rhythm section is the rhythm section, and are kind of, they keep the backbeat as rhythm sections do, but
traditionally, but really well,
right? And so, and she's out front doing this sort of like angular, like bloody
Do you know the word when we watched a little bit of a video in the break? The word that kept coming up to me, and Kevin, you'll know exactly what this means, waffle.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, right.
Like, she is a thin woman.
Yeah. No, I wasn't kidding when I said she's almost two-dimensional. They've talked on, in some of these reviews, they talk about that there are people who feel like she's a little too size zero. But whatever, the band says that there's not, like, she doesn't have an eating disorder. She's just thin. She's just tall and, like, young. So, anyway, Henry Cash is just killing it on lead guitar. And I feel like it gives, you know, for as much as, like, her stage persona makes this, like, she gets out in front and provides that attitude and sort of a lot of the theater of what they do. Really, the thing that makes them feel dangerous is not her deadpan delivery or the fake blood. It's that guy is really...
He just gets after it, man.
Getting after it, yeah.
And you can't fake that.
I can fake it.
Oh, well, good on you.
Yeah.
I want a demonstration.
No, also, I'm constantly lying. But anyway, yeah, no, anyway, I just think that it's, I'll be really, so one of the things that we talked about, and I've referenced the Lemon Twig show a few times, I'm going to do that again. You know, one of the things that we talked about from that band with regard to the album that we covered last year was like, okay, this is really interesting. What feels like it's the next step for them? And there were some obvious things in that instance where you were like, okay, well, I could see them taking a step in direction A or direction B, or starting to do this one thing that they do really well at a more, you know, kind of a more adventurous level. I feel like these guys are taking some risks right out of the gate.
Well, certainly, you know, the other thing, and they don't necessarily sound like them, but it kind of reminds me of that first Strokes record where, like, everybody's going like, whoa, what the fuck? Like, it's like kind of a sucker punch that it's so good.
Right.
But I don't know if the market is ready for them, and I hope
it
is.
Are you saying that because there's so much electronica that's going on out there?
Well, I mean, it's just everything seems to be like prefab beats and, you know, and just like what's being promoted these days doesn't sound like this.
Right.
Which is not to say this isn't a great record. It is. I hope it can, you know.
Maybe it marks a new era of like a return to the more traditional rock and roll, and
I hope so.
Well, like, you know, a lot of times too, it's like you can't really tell the arc in real time. Like, it's sure. Only when we look back like a couple of years from now that we're like, oh, okay, here was this little bubble of like this kind of stuff. I do think that like every time there is a certain amount of like kind of like, for lack of a better term, and this is a sort of a pejorative term, and I don't necessarily mean it this way, like an antiseptic movement. Like, anytime there is something that feels digitized and less analog, there is something historically that has
that'll
come
push
along.
Back against it.
Yeah, like, and it could just be like that's the way the pendulum
there,
swings.
There are plenty of great bands that are, you know, doing something in this vein.
Right,
A Giant Dog here in town, like they're on Merge and like they're getting some attention.
Yeah, but to be fair, like, and we mentioned the Hollywood connections, and I think that is not a small thing. But I also think that there's something to be said for like you've got that card to play, and then you've got like. Just being like young, like they're all potential except what we've seen.
They're
so
approaching
far.
It like they have nothing to lose, which is true. They don't,
right?
Because like they're brand new and young and like, you know, everything should of course goes this way. Like,
well, and I don't think that they're going to be starving artists anytime soon either.
Probably not.
Somebody feed this band.
Well, certainly her.
Right. Okay, so should we do another one?
We should do another one.
All right, you guys should pick one because I picked the first
two. I actually
two.
Want to, but anyway, it's Pussy Tower, which I think is a great song. Kind of an awkward title, but you know.
Well, I do think that
maybe
it goes along
prudish.
A little bit of the shock mojo of her stage performance and like that whole persona. But sure, let's spin it up.
Kevin actually brought up something that I thought was like particularly poignant. It was like, sometimes people who are famous like get that way because they're willing to say things that other people won't.
That most people won't.
Yeah, yeah, most people won't.
Right.
And in that case, I think that is true. Like that is a like what 2.5 minutes of just pure good rock confection. Like it's a blast, but she's singing about.
Somebody asked what that song was about, and she replied in 4 words, "Girls, boys, heartbreak, head." And I mean, that's just not inaccurate. Like that's pretty much what's going on.
I think the last word of that is probably like the takeaway from that. But anyway, it's about receiving oral pleasure.
Wow.
So anyway. But it's just a fun little rock song and probably not going to get a whole lot of radio play.
No, probably not.
I wouldn't think so.
But
no.
It's a blast.
It would be the radio edit of that would be almost nothing.
It would be down to like 20 seconds.
Did I tell you? I did. I think I mentioned this on the show. Well, just a tiny quick sidebar. But it's like, so I saw Run the Jewels and that show, they were taping it for the Austin City Limits. TV show that airs on PBS.
Did you go? I thought your wife went to that, right?
Well, we both went to it. And so, yeah.
Well,
so
she's the one who counts.
Well, clearly. But
I've heard Kevin count. He does a pretty decent job.
I've counted twice. But anyway, yeah. So we went to the Run the Jewels show, and they did. And we were sitting in the audience beforehand, and I thought, how are they going to air this on public television? And they did. I was like, these guys are going to clearly maybe do a cleaned up show or do some like sort of facsimile version of what it is that they do. Nope. They did exactly the same show that they would do every other time. It was a litany of F-bombs.
So I haven't seen the telecast. They just like bleep them.
They don't bleep them. They just cut the sound for every F-bomb or whatever. So it's there's a lot of like.
It's a very staccato performance.
It is a very staccato performance. But it's like, and you still, the energy still comes across, but it's like I tweeted at they tweeted something, the studio tweeted something out about it, and I tweeted back at him. I was like, I was at that taping, and whoever had to, like whatever editor had to like navigate that lyrical minefield is...
earned his paycheck, or her.
Oh, yeah, yeah, totally. And they wrote me back and said, lyrical minefield is a great way to put that. So anyway, I feel like there is a little bit of like that, getting back to what you were saying, there's a little bit of like that performance juju in these guys. It's like you can't be dangerous and do it exactly the same way that everybody else does. And she is, she's, even if it's a persona and a character and she is... The chances that she's taking are scripted. If you haven't seen them before and they're in your face, these guys are.
It's memorable.
It's memorable. It's, they're clearly putting it memorable out there.
There's a certain amount of immediacy that these guys have that you don't see with every band. That I think is what's grabbing people by the lapel and saying like check it out. And there's the, it's a je ne sais quoi kind of thing. Like, you can't put your finger on it, but they have it. And
how do you say?
I don't know what that is.
I don't know how you say. But, yeah, there's a, like, Nirvana had it. Like, I'm not saying they're as good as Nirvana, but, like, they're, in the discussion, at least for bands in the last 10, 15 years, you know, like they've got something going on. Courtney Barnett kind of has the same thing.
Oh, like, sure. Yeah. Well, and she hangs her hat on some other things too, right? Like, so hers is like, there's a little bit of comedy. It's like a slacker
she's funny.
Comedy.
She has a wry humor to her
she's
lyrics.
She's very dry. These guys are, you know.
It's more straight up rock and roll, but like they're firing on all cylinders, as far as I can tell.
Little bit of Arrow trivia. 4 years ago, she appeared in the Lena Dunham directed music video for the Bleachers song "I Want to Get Better."
Oh, we've talked about that on the show.
We have,
and a picture of the back of her head was used for the song's single art. So,
well, she just can't like fall down without being in the middle of something.
Well, she is quite tall, so
yeah.
Any direction that she falls, she's going to be in the middle of something.
That's probably true.
And it's her mother that's the photographer director,
Autumn DeWilde. Yeah. So anyway, yeah, and she's her art is pretty astounding. Like she's clearly got chops. And her father, Arrow's grandfather was also a rock photographer and shot Hendrix and like some of the Woodstock era artists. So it's like their roots go pretty deep, even by LA standards for some of this stuff. And it's like, you know, one thing we haven't talked about is that a lot of times these LA bands kind of come with a little bit of stigma. Like part of what I thought about a lot this week was just how like it's like there are, you know, New York is the New York thing. Nashville, as far as rock
New
music
York's
is
like
concerned,
gritty, you know, or whatever.
Sure. Well, right, and there's a certain type of scene
and
or
you
scenes.
Tend to think of LA bands as being like not have much depth.
Well, and there is a certain amount of that. There's a certain inauthenticity, or like for lack of a better term, like there. Sometimes it seems like sometimes they can come off a little paint by number. Nashville bands, like that being a big music industry town, even beyond the country scene, kind of has always felt a little bit like the LA of the South to me. And then you've got sort of all the other cities that sort of make up the indie circuit. So you've got Seattle and Portland and Austin and some of these others that, you know, and Chicago plays a role too. So it's like, there are these places have personalities, but it is kind of fun to see a band at the same time. Like these guys kind of like, they're kind of on the fence, right? Like they, by lineage, exemplify some of their roots, but they're not inauthentic about it.
No, they don't come off as, you know, like just doing paint by numbers. You know, they don't come off as fake. Now, granted, I don't necessarily find a ton of depth in their music lyrically.
Well, they're not. Yeah, they're not trying to change your life. I don't think.
But fucking kids.
Yeah.
You know, like they also the lyrics don't suck. They're just like really good.
They're of the age. They could be working in that donut shop. We don't know.
Yeah,
totally.
Yeah.
Like you wouldn't be surprised if you went into a donut shop and had one of them, you know, serve you a cruller or whatever the hell.
I might be a little surprised now.
Perhaps. Yeah.
All right. Well, who's got
Mark has
who's got the end of
the
show.
The final
I've
segment.
Got the end of the show today, guys. So I wanted to found this little gem while kind of running around the Polyvinyl Records catalog, and this is a new song, a new side project from Merrick Long of the Dodos. The outfit is called Fan, and the song we're going to listen to is Velour.
Don't think I'd stand around and just watch you.
Okay, this is from the Polyvinyl website. You know, we were talking about Merrick Long of the Dodos, who put this song together, and it says, conceived upon hearing an irreproducible pattern, meaning he couldn't produce it again, made from the sound of a broken fan in a restaurant bathroom, fans music is created using two synths left behind after his father's passing. And then this is what I thought was really interesting. He said, for a musician who spent many years primarily playing guitar, the shift to writing and synthesizers was initially daunting, but doing so gave Long the opportunity to finally embrace a wealth of childhood influences, including Nintendo soundtracks, Devo, Brian Eno, and Prince.
Well, that part's obvious. I do kind of think the video like overshadows the song.
Sure.
And I was fucking confused. Yeah, I'm just glad I wasn't on any sort of psychedelic drugs while watching that, because I'd have to go watch it again and again and again and again. But song's called what? Voyeur?
Velour, actually.
Oh, yeah. Velour. Okay, but there is a guy who's a voyeur in it.
Yeah.
And then he becomes part of the game.
She finds the remote, and then he's in the game.
Yeah. So apparently the video, I'm not sure if it was the video or if it was the song Velour, but was kind of in homage to Sasha Velour, which is, sorry, I'm totally not hip to RuPaul, but RuPaul has a,
I was going to say, that sounds like a drag queen.
It is a drag queen, yeah. So
okay.
I think the song itself was written kind of...
as an homage? Like,
yeah, Merrick talks about like...
Oh yeah, look, there you go. There's
Merrick kind of talks about like how watching this Sasha Velour on RuPaul's Drag Race, just like, and the energy that came out of that, and just how he says that he was mesmerized by the queen's artistry. So apparently it says, I couldn't stop thinking about it for days afterwards, and every time I did, I could literally feel this surge of energy well up inside of me, the singer said in a statement. I couldn't believe the amount of energy transferred across television waves. Sounds a little, whatever.
Over the top.
But I think that's... It's that energy that he was trying to capture with the electronic.
Well, to me, that was just a big bowl of surreal.
That's what you have for breakfast.
It's true.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it was surreal. And I do think that I do think that it was kind of, it's an interesting juxtaposition, since we're talking about, you know, the difference, since we've spent most of this show talking about synthesizers giving way to traditional instruments.
Yeah, like a rock band.
Yeah.
In, you know, the,
and then this is a guy who put down his guitar.
This is a guy who, yeah, put down his guitar and just decided to fuck with shit.
Picked up a keyboard. Yeah. So let's make some video game music.
And actually, the credits were maybe the best part of that
they
video.
They were. Yeah. Yeah, if you watch it, if you pull up that video, the credits have a lot of beep, bop, boop.
If you've ever spent any time with the original Nintendo, like, you'll love the credits to that.
Well, and not a lot of people know this, but like that last part of the show is in 8-bit. So we're super old school.
It's true.
I don't know about that. Okay. Yeah. Well, anyway, I really dug this stuff. You know, I really just stumbled across it earlier today and went out and pre-ordered the album. It comes out in May.
Hey, so there you go. So now you could plan your whole we always talk about like songs should be like soundtracks to a certain party.
Yeah,
like you can plan your video game theme party around that record. But
I'm already on that, Kevin.
Okay, that's good.
It's
wasn't Polyvinyl like basically like an emo only label for the longest time?
Well, and Mark and I went to the Polyvinyl showcase at South By this year. Did we see that guy?
No, I don't believe so.
I feel like I would have remembered because it sounded a little bit different than what I recall that we came across. But yeah.
There was some electronica stuff, but there was also some more acoustic
feel. Yeah, they
seem
to have shifted their focus.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, yeah.
Well, Dodos are extinct, Ryan, so you got to go do something else.
Okay. All right. I will go do something else other than hunting Dodos, which... for as long as I've lived, it's never worked out.
No, it probably hasn't. All right. Well, hey, dudes, this was a funyun. And what do we got? Who's got next?
Well, it might be Shane if he's coming back in.
Well,
I think it is his turn because, yeah, I don't have anything queued up.
All right. Well, I'll tell you what. We'll just we'll make it a surprise for everybody.
Yeah, mystery.
Yes, but until
it's not
then,
that much of a surprise because they actually like
maybe we can just
it.
Have Shane call you and leave a voicemail and you can just patch it in.
Oh, certainly, I could probably do that.
Yeah.
Well, and Kevin and I also talked about some future stuff that we're wanting to do as well.
Yeah, we're gonna do from now on
futuristic music.
No, yes. Well, from now on we're gonna do future records. These are records that haven't come out yet or been conceived of.
Somebody might like this.
Somebody who knows?
Somebody might think of this. All right. Okay, dudes. Well, let's hitch the wagons. Till next week, I'm Kevin.
I'm Ryan.
I'm Mark.
This is Somebody Likes It.